Well, we're off now for four lectures on what I think for many people will be the hard core of the course, politics, the state. If, in a way, I think one way of thinking about the course as a whole, if the course as a whole is subsumed under the banner of Marx's famous 11th thesis on Feuerbach, philosophers have only interpreted the world, the point is to change it. The way you change the world is through politics. That's what changes, how change takes place, in the way that the point is to change the world means. Social change occurs behind the backs of actors all the time. It's just as the cumulative unintended consequences of what we do in life. Much of history is the accumulation of unintended consequences that occur behind the backs of actors. But in the Marxian framework of an emancipatory vision for transformation, the central idea is how can we mobilize our ideas, our theoretical understandings, and so on, to not merely interpret the world, but to actually facilitate deliberate change. And that's what politics is fundamentally about. It's about transforming the social world in which we live. The stuff on class and class formation is kind of the context of helping define what it is that needs changing and what are some of the raw ingredients. And our discussion about ideology, which will follow the centerpiece on politics, is fundamentally about how do we understand the subjective obstacles to change and how do we deal with that. But all of that then comes together in a focal point around the practices of changing the world, and that's what politics is. So in some ways then, this is the pivot of the class. As I've said at the beginning, I think, of every session, we really need probably about eight classes on these four topics. As you can see from the cluttered character of today's outline, you know, I had to kind of squeeze and reduce the spaces between lines to keep it on one page. We will be continually facing the hopeless task of my wanting to rein in how much I talk about this stuff in order to give us a chance to discuss and wanting to get through all the ideas and be sure they're really clear. And since I hold two contradictory beliefs about pedagogy, and I hold them both really strongly, one is that people learn by talking, not just by listening. That is, the way you process information is by communicating with other people, not just by listening. I absolutely believe that. I also believe that hearing certain ideas rather than just reading them, because of the way brains work, helps to make things clearer. So I could say exactly what I had written on the page, say it out loud to you, and it's going to go through different neural circuits, and you process it differently. Partially that's because we're all used to, throughout our lives, engaging in conversation. And one of the things you do when you're in conversation is you have an interior monologue, an interior conversation with yourself about what you're hearing. Right? Sometimes when people, well, in general, when people read, they don't engage in that same kind of interior processing as they hear, in the kind of on-the-spot way that you always do when you're having a conversation, when you're paying attention, of course, not when you're having a conversation where your mind is wandering. And I know, of course, because of our wonderful 3 minutes of meditation, no one's mind wanders a bit in this class, right? I'm sure. That's clear. So the contradictions in my pedagogical views are, I want to say these things out loud to you because I do think it makes a difference. And more for some people than others. You know, we have very different learning styles, inevitably. And I want us all to have lots of conversation. So, you know, ideally, if the world was a different world and I could snap my fingers, what I'd really like is for these sessions to be sort of 2.5 hours long and for us to have a you know, a nice meal together and to have carry on a conversation, etc. Okay, we're not in that world. We'll soldier on. These four lectures are really, the way I want to approach it is it's a kind of continuous time space for these four topics, which I've kind of arbitrarily broken down. And so what I'll do is probably not get through all of the material today, because in order to give us space for conversation. And I'll just wrap this one up on Thursday and probably then not get through Thursdays and wrap it up on Tuesday, and then probably not get through Tuesdays and wrap it up next Thursday. And then, be as it may, we'll either not finish everything or we will, depending upon how things go. All right, enough excuses and little prologue-y homilies. For this lecture in particular, because a lot of what I'll be presenting here has a little bit the character of one of our dictionary exercises, I'm going to very carefully define all the ingredients that go into this discussion of politics, I think hopefully in a useful way. But this is an example where I think really feel have your trigger point for asking a question as we go below, and not just clarifying questions. That is, if you have some hesitations about some points or some comment that you want to make, just jump in. And rather than have me lecture uninterrupted and then have a discussion at the end, I think that'll work better for this. There's two basic things I want to do today. The first is to do this careful laying out of the ingredients, the basic concepts that are going to figure in our discussion of politics. This will also help set up in some ways the discussion of ideology. A little bit of this will bear on that discussion. And then I want to briefly give you a way of thinking about the classical Marxian idea of the state and politics by reviewing this formulation that's referred to as the base and superstructure model. This is a model of way of thinking, theorizing the state, which is most people kind of reject out of hand as sort of silly and reductionist. I think it's actually a pretty subtle and interesting idea. And while I do think it has flaws, I think it remains the point of departure for the Marxist perspective on the state. And the base superstructure model is too simple. It's one of the cases where I think, as I've said, I prefer oversimplification to over-complexification. But I think this case has proven to be oversimplified in a way that has unproductive consequences. And therefore, we need to recomplexify it a bit in critical ways, which is what we'll be doing in the subsequent sessions on the state. But I want to lay out this oversimplified version because I do think it contains a core insight which gets lost sometimes when it gets rejected out of hand. That'll be the second part of the lecture, but that part's going to be what sort of spills over into Thursday. So first, basic concepts. And I'll build this up step by step. All right, our first concept to kind of grapple with is a sort of meta concept. This applies to all sorts of things, and it's the idea of practice. Practice. I think I may have already said this a little bit, or at least worked around it in some other lectures. I like the Latin rather than the Greek, praxis. I never quite know what is being added when people put an X instead of... That's all. As far as I can tell, practice as a way of talking about human activity and praxis is just whether you prefer your Greek or your Latin roots. I don't think there's any deeper thing in play here. Maybe there is that I'm just not aware of. So first, let's just discuss the idea of practice. Practice is a way of thinking about human action in which you look at what people do in the world in terms of the transformative effects of our activities. So to use the kind of least theoretically laden term, human beings engage in behaviors. We just act in the world. We do things. And there is a tradition, of course, in the social sciences that at one point, this term has gotten out of favor, we were called the behavioral sciences. And the subject of our inquiries was human behavior. human, to regard what we do as behavior is to amalgamate our activities with those of animals, because we talk about animal behavior and human behavior. You don't talk about animal action or animal practice. You talk about animals' behavior. So there was a time when human beings were treated in some branches of psychology especially, but also this bled into sociology as well. We were regarded as just a particular species of creatures, and we behaved in different ways from dogs, but we were studying our behavior. That's pretty much fallen out of favor. Practice is a way of thinking about what we do from a particular vantage point. When we talk about human activity in terms of its transformative effects in the world, this doesn't imply that our actions are nothing other than transformative effects. It doesn't mean that the subjective meanings of actors are unimportant. This is just a particular way, a particular dimension of human action to emphasize. And indeed, this is something we're going to be spending a lot of time with, particularly when we get to ideology. It's precisely how to understand the connection between the conscious purposive actions of transformation to other aspects of our subjectivities and our actions. That's going to be a theme we're going to be discussing in general. Okay, so look, if you observe people, you can ask all sorts of questions and describe their actions in all sorts of ways. You can do what in a certain Weberian tradition people do and say, what are the meanings of the actions to the actors? That's one way of looking at action. It's meaningful. We described some other ways of looking at action a couple of lectures ago. We said one way of looking at action is that it's scripted. People are filling roles like actors on a stage. The word actor, has these different connotations. On the one hand, an actor on a stage is filling a role in which they are told what to say. And if they do it well, they say all the words that they were told. But they infuse those words with particular emotion and style and whatever that comes from their own internal agency. But yet, they're heavily constrained. You know, when you go to see Hamlet, you want Hamlet to get every word in it to be in or not to be speech right. You know, you want an absolute correct, not improvised. You don't want a whole lot of agency in the choice of words. That's scripted behavior, scripted action. Well, as we said, that's a very impoverished view of human beings, and it turns out not to be very explanatory for all sorts of things, which is why we introduced intentional action and strategic action. Well, here we're taking a different take on the question, how should we think about action? We should analyze action in this perspective in terms of its transformative effects on the world. We want to see how our actions work on the world in different ways. To do this, I think it's helpful to think of a very general format that you use if you want to analyze human activity in this way. If you want to think of our actions as engagements in the world that transform things, then there's a general format. Every discussion of practice involves an analysis of the raw materials of practice, that is, what is it you're transforming? The means of transformation, what are the instruments, tools, organizations used to accomplish the transformation, the process of transformation, that's sort of the labor process of actually doing the transformation, and what's the product. The paradigm example, which makes it clear what I'm talking about, this is all kind of brushing around with words, is economic practice. So what happens when you engage in economic activity, thinking of it as a practice? Well, there's raw materials, let's call it nature. There are means of transformation, we call those means of production, the productive forces. There's a process of transformation, a labor process through which you use means of production to transform nature, and the result is a product, a use value. So when you engage in economic activity, and look at it from the point of view of practice, what you want to do is then say, aha, okay, now what we got to do, what are the raw materials, nature in various forms, inputs, what are the means of production, the forces of production, how are they used to actually transform nature? That's the labor process. What's the product? Well, that little format that's transparent for the case of economic practice, actually, I think is also quite useful for thinking about political practice and other kinds of practice. I'll give a long list of types of practice. There's political practice, ideological practice, we'll talk about that, cultural practice, can even talk about religious practice. Gets a little maybe loosey-goosey, you know, maybe a little less clear exactly what the raw material is and what's the product, but still, there's reasons to think about the means of production having to do with the way the labor process has to do with way rituals are used and symbols get used as tools to produce particular kinds of meaning systems. You know, so we can think of religious practice as a very particular aspect of ideological practice or cultural practice. You know, there's different dimensions here in which particular kinds of meanings get produced that are not just generic meaning. It's a particular kind of meaning, and it's produced through a set of practices. Now, there's nothing magic about this. Practice isn't the only way of talking about things. To say there's religious practices means you're going to look at what happens in religions in terms of how they're taking some raw materials and working on them in some way to produce some kind of outcome. It's to regard all of our activities as a kind of production process. You know, that's a kind of heavy-handed way of describing it. Economic practices transforms nature to produce use values. Ideological practice transforms human lived experience into subjectivity, takes the raw materials of all the things we experience and transforms them into beliefs. That's a way of thinking about how you get your beliefs, which is different from saying beliefs are just poured into you. You know, you're a vessel and you just are a receiver of messages which get burned into your brain. This is saying, no, it's not just that you're a tape recorder. Rather, there's a process that goes on by which things that you experience in your life are given interpretations through work. It takes a labor process, and the labor process occurs in schools, it occurs in the media, it occurs in all sorts of places in which beliefs get formed as ideas, as cognitive products that you actually hold and are committed to, as opposed to simply ideas you know about. Yeah?
Where is the place for social practice, like French? Is it political practice, or is it a different one?
So there is a political aspect of in the general sense that I will be describing political practice. I didn't give you the definition yet, let me do that. Political practices are human actions that transform social interactions into social relations. So it would be an aspect of political practice to take the raw material of your interactions with others and transform them into a stable social relation that we would call a friendship. We label relations. So you have interactions with people and they get transformed into relations. And in this very general notion of political practice, what are political practices? They are the practices through which social relations are produced. The forming of a friendship would have this political aspect to it. Now, that's a context in which I myself don't find it very insightful to describe that as everything that goes on in the forming of a friendship as political, because of the absence of power in all. It's not a ubiquitous aspect of friendship formation, that it involves the use of power. And so there's a question as to whether or not in those domains of social life in which the forming of relations are fully symmetrical and reciprocal, whether we really want to talk about it as still a political practice, or whether we want to restrict the use of the word political to those cases where power and interests and conflicts are involved. So it may be that my desire to have a nice, clean vocabulary, which you can state at a very abstract level and then refine, that runs sufficiently against ordinary language use here as to not be so constructive, right? So when I say ideological practice are the practices by which human lived experience is turned into subjectivity, and we talk about how a loving parent helps a baby, a toddler, interpret their world and gives them categories to think about it, and we say, well, the parent is certainly engaged in a practice that's transforming lived experience into subjectivity, to beliefs and understandings. Do we want to really say that's an ideological practice? Well, that's a kind of like the friendship case. You know, it's using the term ideological practice in this very general way that doesn't necessarily bring with it the baggage of domination, subordination, and so on. The same is true for economic practice. Do we really want to describe cooking dinner at home where you're transforming nature using skillets and stoves under particular labor process within the social relations of the family to produce a product, the meal on the table? Do we want to say that's an economic practice? Or do we only want to say it's economic when it's engaged with the world of exchange and domination and inequality? Right, so there's two impulses here. And so this is part of the problem of concept formation, right? It's one of our just general methodological issues. There's two kind of issues here. One is to give a very general set of tools and then give them specificity for in different contexts. Or to begin and saying, no, that's really too abstract. It doesn't give us enough action. We need to frame our concepts in the first instance, the most abstract level at a lower level. Yeah?
I was just wondering, do you think that power and domination is an inherent characteristic of practice then? So, because it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, friendship isn't really a political practice because it doesn't, you know, really, it doesn't always involve power and domination.
Right.
And, you know, cooking dinner is really an economic practice because engage with the world in a dominating way. So
right.
is that kind of domination characteristic?
So what I would say is it always involves power, but not domination.
Okay.
Power, we'll get to that in a little bit, but I can prefigure it here. I think the concept of power should be defined also very abstractly in the first instance. Namely, power is your capacity to do things. You have a lot of power when you have a lot of capacity. You have little power when you have little capacity. We can talk about somebody who has a great capacity to form friendships and other people have a very weak capacity. Well, they have a capacity to form particular kinds of social relations. They may or may not use that power to dominate people. It may be that it's just a capacity which then facilitates the formation of symmetrical relations with people, in which people with lower capacity nevertheless equally benefit from the social relation that's so constructed. So power does not, in my use of the term power, does not necessarily mean domination. In some sociological and social theoretical discussions, the word power inherently means domination. If power is used to mean domination, then we don't need the word domination, but we need another word for what I'm calling power, the capacity to do things. So maybe the proper way is to talk about capacities which only become power when they're used for domination. I'm not wedded to one vocabulary. I just think it's important for people to be clear about what their vocabulary is. So I use the word domination to mean this asymmetrical form of power where one person has, or group, has control over, in various senses, other people. Economic practice, ideological practice, and political practice need not imply domination. Okay? So, as a shorthand, we can say, We can define practices by what they produce. Economic practices produce use values, political practices produce social relations, ideological practices produce subjectivity. When we get to the study of ideology, I'll make a distinction between ideological and cultural practices. This isn't conventional, but I think it helps clarify things. So the way I make this distinction is that ideological practices produce the conscious components of subjectivity, and cultural practices produce the unconscious aspects. So, for example, ideology produces a belief in the desirability of competition, of competitiveness, of individualism. Cultural practices produce individualistic people, people whose underlying dispositions, ways of being in the world, are competitive and individualistic. That means you can have the ideology without the culture. You can be a lousy competitor and just be completely unable to effectively compete. You have none of the dispositions. You're not aggressive. You don't like to put down people. You don't, you know, that just isn't built into your character. And yet you believe competition is a good thing. And therefore you feel miserable because there's a disjuncture between your culture and your ideology. That turns out to be a huge point of leverage in social change. The fact that ideologies and cultures do not automatically fit together. What's called consciousness raising, for example, in the women's movement in the 70s, you know, the women's liberation movement in its heyday, consciousness raising was the view that you can change people's ideologies, that is, you can get them to consciously understand that they have to be more assertive and stand up for themselves in the world because it's their right to do so, even though their dispositions were still, well, I'm a woman, I don't behave that way. You know, that wasn't how they felt comfortable with, but you could change the cultural dispositions via the ideological dispositions. That was the theory of consciousness raising, that you can change people's underlying dispositions by working on their beliefs. And it was pretty successful. You know, I think it has, and in a way, that's kind of what a lot of therapy is all about. A lot of therapy is about how do you change people's underlying dispositions to act by way of acting on their beliefs, on their conscious purposes. Well, that's foreshadowing what we'll do later, and that's a way of thinking about ideological and cultural practices, because in the consciousness raising, you're engaged in an activity, an attempt to change something. So again, that's putting this practice at the center. The reason why I think putting transformation at the center of our understanding of human action is precisely because the whole theory is designed to help us illuminate the process of transforming the world. You know, if that's what you want your theory to do, then you want to emphasize in your decoding and deciphering of human action those transformative moments, that aspect of it. Okay, 1.3. The concept of reproduction. Now, this is a kind of slippery point, and it's one which I'm not sure the language that I'm proposing, this kind of menu, this vocabulary, works smoothly. So, you know, this is in the spirit of showing you if you don't quite at this point, it's maybe not gettable, as opposed to you haven't quite figured it out yet. It has to do with thinking of social reproduction as a kind of transformation. So here's the basic problem. Here's why this is a kind of awkward point. We are always already living in societies with well-established social relations. So when we talk about political practices as transforming social interactions into relations, the problem is those interactions are occurring inside of relations. It's not the case that we are engaged in the world in raw, unrelational interactions and only then transform them into relations. So it's a little different from the economic practice. You see, the economic practices, we could say, well, there's nature, that's raw materials. They get extracted and then transformed through a labor process into products. And there's a sense in which nature is pre-social. I don't mean that there's pristine nature out there, but there is, you know, iron ore in the ground before it's dug up by human agency. It exists for reasons in the ground other than our human agency. So this kind of simple format, you've got something you act on, works clearly in the economic case. In the political practice case, the problem is that we're already always in social relations. And a lot of political practices seem to be doing the work of maintaining existing relations rather than transforming them into anything. And therefore, it's a little more awkward just how you want to talk about this. So one way of doing this, and this again may be just finessing the problem rather than really giving a completely clear and transparent understanding, one way of thinking about this issue is to think of reproducing a social relation as a transformation of a relation into itself. Reproduction of a relation is a form of its transformation. Some kinds of relations may be basically reproduced by what one could reasonably describe as social inertia. That is, their existence is the central explanation of their persistence. That is an explanation of why, of how a relation continues that says it's inertia, says it continues because it exists. Existence explains persistence. If this is the case, then I would say in such relations where their existence is the main thing that explains their persistence, political practice doesn't play a role in their reproduction over time, not an interesting role. This happens when certain kinds of interactions are maintained completely as habits or routines. The clearest case of this, I think, are certain kinds of benign social conventions. The social convention that you drive on the right-hand or the left-hand side of the road, which is, of course, enforced in law, but it's not the enforcement of law that keeps you from driving on the other side of the road, right? It's not that every time you approach an empty street, you say, well, should I drive on the left or right-hand side of the road? What's my chance of getting caught? No, you know, that's not at all, there's no enforcement of that rule that matters. That's not why the social relation that binds together the interactions of actors on highways, it's enforced because it's a benign convention, and once established, everybody establishes it, you know, internalizes it as a routine in ways that makes it just self-perpetuating. And conventions work that way, yeah. Yeah, so a lot of things have a lot of that character. Now, the thing is, without certain kinds of social activity, some of those conventions will deteriorate over time, but not all of them will. This also bears on the question, do we really want to say that the work that friends do to maintain their friendship, do we want to call that political work? Does that really capture the process by which they are maintaining their relations? Well, sometimes it might, sometimes it might not. So those become the areas where this discussion just may not be the most helpful way of thinking about things. I don't think there's any necessity for a theory of class politics to also use the word, use its language in a way that's fully appropriate for friendships, although there are undoubtedly intersections. So the way to think about this is the following. When social relations embody intrinsic conflicts of interest, that is, when the relations in question involve antagonism, then they're clearly not self-perpetuating through inertia and do require active practices to reproduce the relationship. Reproduction of antagonistic social relations requires, to a greater or lesser extent, some kind of process of blocking change. And therefore, the stability of those relations, that is their reproduction, is produced through social practices, and I think they're appropriately then called political practices. This is particularly important for things with highly antagonistic character like class relations and class domination. They require specific kinds of practices with the purpose of reproducing those relations. The enforcement of property rights, for example, is not something that just casually happens through convention. It happens through the concentrated use of social resources of various sorts to impose punishments on people who violate property rights. And that's a necessary condition for the reproduction of the social relation that we call property rights. Property rights is a description of a social relation, and it requires this kind of these kinds of deliberate practices of their maintenance. And I think it's the way to think about it, the shorthand, without getting into too much obscurity, is to think of this as a case where a relation is transformed into itself. That is, that's what reproduction is. Reproduction, social reproduction of relations, involves political practices insofar as the stability of the relations requires an active process of blocking change of those relations, that is, reproducing it into itself. There was a hand up at one point here, or a raised eyebrow, or a slight grimace. Okay. Type versus aspect of practice. Now this is, again, I'm just giving you a language in which you can kind of sort stuff out that otherwise might get confusing. This is relevant particularly for political and ideological practices. To distinguish the political aspects of a social practice in general from political practice as a type of practice. So when I use the word political as an adjective to the word practice, I mean it as a type of practice. So political practice is contrasted to economic practice or ideological practice. But the word political can also be used to describe an aspect of a practice that is not itself a political practice. Okay, so this is why this gets confusing. You can talk about the political aspect of an economic practice, and you can talk about a political practice. Okay, what the hell is going on with that use of language? What am I talking about? To speak of the political aspect of a social practice is to discuss the ways in which a given practice reproduces and transforms relations, even if those transformations weren't intended by the actors. To speak about political practice as a type of practice implies that the intention, the purposes of the actors, is the reproduction or transformation of relations. Actors are conscious subjects, and they may take social relations as the intentional object of their actions. So in this classroom, we're engaged in practices, right? We're engaged in activities in which we're producing and transforming things. Now, my efforts primarily are to transform your subjectivity. I'm engaged in ideological practices here. I'm giving you information, ideas, which if you're paying attention and listening to, you then take inside of your minds and work on through your internal practices, and then these ideas become instantiated as beliefs. I mean, we'll discuss this process when we discuss ideology, and also then do a very tricky distinction between ideological practices and theoretical practices. It's another elusive topic, but let's not get into that. A foreman, in a production process, on a labor process, people are engaged in economic practices. But they are also producing and reproducing the relations in production as a byproduct of simply doing their work in the labor process. When a foreman walks up and down and imposes a sanction for shirking, the informant at that moment is engaged in a political practice. That is, what that foreman is doing is enforcing a particular balance of power and set of rules governing the behavior of people. That's the foreman engaging in a political practice. But when the workers are just working on the line and engaged in their labor process and interacting with each other to produce the products, there is still a political aspect of their practices, because their practices are reinforcing a set of interaction routines that are stabilized as social relations. Politics is the term we use when we are discussing the interactions among political practices in which the political aspects are intentionally produced. So politics is the term for the interaction of political practices. When you engage in politics, what you're doing is purposefully engaging in the activity of trying to transform relations, confronting purposive activity of others trying to transform those relations in the same or different ways, or reproducing those relations. Politics is, in a sense, the concatenation of political practices. You're engaging in politics when you're not just trying to transform relations, but you're trying to transform relations in a world where other actors are acting on those relations as well. Yeah. Well, it mostly has political aspects. There are moments when I treat the nature of our relations as itself a conscious object to try to forge in particular ways.
You're trying to change our social relations. That would make it a political practice.
Right. To the extent that I'm trying to change your social relations, to the extent I'm trying to change your ideas, it's ideological practice. That is, mostly the purpose of teachers is to teach ideas. Teaching ideas means communicating them away to you in a way that they become embodied in your cognitive structures. And here's the subtle distinction between an ideological practice and a theoretical practice, you know, to prefigure something we'll talk about. If I simply want to indoctrinate you with these ideas so that you believe them, because I've indoctrinated you, then that's ideological practice. I'm just simply trying, all I care about is shaping your ideas. If I'm trying to give you tools by which you then process information and ideas and make judgments about them, so that you can apply rational, systematic, you know, in quotes, scientific ways of evaluating your own beliefs. So what I'm doing is actually enhancing your reflexivity about your own beliefs, rather than simply inculcating your beliefs. Then I'm engaged in what would be called a theoretical practice, or a scientific practice. That is, I'm still trying to inculcate beliefs, trying to get you to understand certain things, but it's a different way of doing it. This is something we'll talk about later. You know, this, you can see why this is slippery. This is not an easy point. This is dealing with, you know, pretty abstract or difficult issues in the relationship between the purely cognitive psychological aspects of this and the more philosophical methodological aspects. So let's not waylay this discussion there. But that, but I also, because I'm very self-conscious myself about the nature of classroom relations, about the problem of professors having power over students, and how that interferes with the free exchange of ideas and the, and I understand students' sense of vulnerability, both with respect to fellow students and with respect to professors. And I work on that. I worry about those things. So I am definitely engaged in the political practice of trying to forge particular kinds of relationships in a classroom, and not merely the ideological practice of trying to inculcate particular ideas to my students. And sometimes those are happening simultaneously, but more often than not, I'm mostly working on the pedagogical communicative side in most of the time, and then only sometimes say, okay, I remind everybody, be sure to ask questions. I say, let's relax, you know, and so on. All right. Political. So the word politics is derivative from the idea of political practice. Because political practices confront each other, interact with each other, it's that confrontation and interaction of political practices that is what we call politics. Politics is the set of political, of interacting political practices in any context. University politics are the way in which all the efforts to produce and transform social relations in the university interact with each other under asymmetrical conditions of power in the case of universities. Okay. 1.5. The multiplicity of types of political practice. So if we understand... If we understand political practice in this way, every kind of social relation has an associated form of politics. Gender politics produce and reproduce gender relations. Classroom politics produce and reproduce relations between teachers and students. And class politics produce and reproduce class relations. In the feminist tradition, when feminists talk about the personal is political, that expression, the personal is political, is an affirmation of the idea that there are social relations at the most personal level and that they aren't natural, they're not given, they're not fixed by some unalterable laws of nature, but are transformable through human agency. If personal relations were untransformable, if they were simply laws of nature, so to speak, then it would not make sense to say the personal is political. It would be, you know, not an appropriate way of thinking about the problem of domestic relations, of interpersonal, intimate relations. The feminist idea that the personal is political is a way of characterizing those relations as transformable. The way I've described it so far is considerably more general than is typically found in Marxist discussions of politics and political practice, and in particular because I haven't restricted the notion of politics to the state, and some Marxists want to do that. They say that politics is only counts as politics when it's about the state. And other times, and also because I haven't identified politics and political practices strictly with domination. If you regard politics as exclusively about the state and only relevant where there is domination, then to use the kind of classical Marxian idea, if there was ever a withering away of the state, there would also be a withering away of politics. In a society without states and domination, there would be no politics and no political practices. In the definition that I'm using, the word political and political practice is an intrinsic feature of human social life, because regardless of anything else, people are going to engage in the practices of producing and transforming relations. So even if we had a utopian communal society without domination, if it was fully democratic and egalitarian in the strong, you know, emancipatory ways that the utopian image might suggest, there would still be politics. There wouldn't be a withering away of politics. And indeed, one might argue that politics would become a more central feature of everyday life because people would much more consciously be aware of the problems of reproducing a set of egalitarian relations. They wouldn't take it for granted. They would understand that there are corrosive tendencies, unintended consequences, which, if not attended to, could undercut the sustainability of the more egalitarian and participatory relations. So if that were true, that is, if it were the case that once established a communal egalitarian and participatory society was self-perpetuating, if that were true, that once established, it continues by inertia, that its existence explains its persistence, then that one could say there's a withering away of politics as well, that politics no longer would matter. People wouldn't have to consciously have as part of their purposes the maintenance of particular relations. But that's wildly implausible. I just can't imagine a structure of social relations under egalitarian conditions that wouldn't be constantly under corrosive influences that could be attended to. I'm not saying that they are inherently degrading, but which have to be attended to, and that means politics would continue to be a central feature, and as I said, perhaps even a more central feature in the sense that everybody would be more consciously aware that these were dangers and that these were things that had to be attended to. Okay, that gets us through the first item, politics. Now we get to power. Power. Now there's a heavy word that really invites obscurantism. If there's a term among the many opportunities that social theorists have found to write in extremely obscure ways about things, power is certainly one of the premier ones. I like to think of power in a very simple and straightforward way. Power is the capacity to produce the transformations specific to any particular practice. So economic power refers to your capacity to transform nature. Political power is your capacity to transform and produce social relations. And ideological power is your power to produce and transform subjectivity. You have a lot of ideological power if you are really good at producing and transforming subjectivity. In sociology, the term charisma, charismatic power, you know, charismatic authority, and so on. The word charisma is sometimes used as a way of describing the capacities that some people have to transform other people's beliefs. A charismatic figure is someone who has this magical power, and you know, it's thought of as almost magical because of the way they can take masses of people and get them to believe things other than what they believed before. That's a pretty incredible capacity to do. And it's, I think, quite appropriate to use the word power to describe that ability. But power also applies to your ability to chop down a tree. You know, you're a powerful person if you can wield a heavy axe. You're powerful in the physical sense of your abilities to transform nature. So I think power is just the capacity to produce transformations. That's all it is. You can have a lot or a little of it. There's different forms of it. It can be robust or fragile. It doesn't inherently imply domination. A group can be powerful. A collectivity can be powerful in its ability to do things, or it can be weak in its ability to do things. And that doesn't necessarily mean its ability to dominate other people. Although we'll see, power and domination do obviously have deep connections. Second point about political power. A really important distinction, which loomed very large in discussions around the state when I was in the midst of the Marxist Renaissance of the late 60s and 70s. It's declined a bit, this particular terminology. You don't encounter so much. I still think it's a useful bit of terminology to get clear on. And it's the distinction between what can be called instrumental and structural power. Instrumental power and structural power. The expression capacity to transform, which is the way I define power, has both an instrumental meaning and a structural meaning. The instrumental one is the simplest one. To say that a particular group or individual has a great deal of political power in this instrumental sense means that they control a variety of resources which enables them to transform relations as they wish. These resources constitute the means of production of political practice, and the conscious use of those means of production of political practice to accomplish transformations is what we call politics. As we'll see, the state is itself a key means of production. It's a key instrument for the production and transformation of relations. What we call laws are one of the key ways, and public policies, etc., are the key ways that these means of production get used to produce and transform social relations. That's the instrumental. Instrumental use of power means that people are consciously wielding some instrument of power. They're using some instrumentality which they have control over. In the case of economic power, it's wealth. In the case of political power, it's to be discussed. We haven't yet nailed it down. That's instrumental. It is wielded by human agents. But in addition to instrumental meaning of power, it's also important to specify a sense in which a group can be structurally powerful politically, even if the individuals do not consciously wield instruments of political power. So a group can be powerful, and it can be powerful politically in the sense that its position results in the reproduction and transformation of relations, even if they don't wield that power as instruments. This occurs when the, and here's the complicated bit, okay? This occurs when the unintended political aspects of social practices reproduces or transform relations in ways that serves the interests of the group in question. So when the unintended aspects of your practices reproduces your position in your interests, even without you doing anything consciously, then you have strong structural power. For example, and here's the simplest example, the economic practices of capitalists have systematic political effects. So the patterns of investment and disinvestment, the fact that if the business climate is adverse, capitalists will move their investments elsewhere. This has consequences for reproducing social relations. And this is, doesn't require capitalists to engage in an investment strike. That is, capitalists, when they move their investment from a low profit rate to a high profit rate area, from a low corporate tax, from a high corporate tax to a low corporate tax area, their purpose is not to get the government to change its tax rates. Their purpose is just to get higher profits. That's all they're caring about. Indeed, a capitalist could be very progressive and liberal and vote for high taxes all the time and still move their investments to low tax rate places. You know, there are plenty of people who have their investments in a portfolio with an investment manager in which they tell the investment manager, maximize my rate of return, and then they vote for social democratic parties. That is, they don't put their investments in a low tax, low rate of return investment just out of political commitment. Typically, people just invest, and then they act politically, often in completely contradictory ways. That's true. You know, that's true for most people. So the point of that is that capitalists have structural power, not just instrumental power, because their position in the social order means that their decisions in organizing their life in ordinary ways, just doing their thing, has political effects that act in their interests. Now, they would not have structural power if the unintended consequences of their ordinary actions undermined their interests. You know, that would say that their capacity to realize their interests in the world is undermined by the unintended consequences of their actions. It's only when the unintended effects mimic what they would choose to do if they wielded their power that one can really say they have structural power, as opposed to that their actions simply have unintended consequences. Yeah?
So in the current variant that you're speaking of, in a world where there are results that are not in the interest of the parties that initiate that, that are, I guess, logical to benefit from them, does that mean that, I guess, other classes have structural power and would end up going the other way?
Well, it
seems like there's a plausible aspect.
Yeah, so you'd really have to play it out in the specific case. It can just be that the system lacks structural power, that it's chaotic rather than powerful. That is that it's not serving anybody's interests. That the unintended consequences are simply causing disorganization. Causing chaos.
Right, but those sorts of scenarios have a tendency to not last so long. No.
It's just, we'll get into this,
okay.
Whether there's a meta, so there is a tendency among Marxists, and this is part of the base superstructure argument, mm-hmm. to assume some long-term functionality, that things, when bad practices are undermining the power of capital and creating these sort of dissolution effects, that they'll be ultimately self-correcting through conscious politics. That is, when things get out of hand, there'll be an intervention of some sort. That assumes a capacity for accurate understanding of the causal processes involved, which, you know, as the current situation suggests, may not always be present. Okay, that's instrumental and structural power. So the last little wrinkle that I added, that sometimes structural power may be weak because the unintended consequences of one's practices may actually be bad, undermining one's position. You can put that aside. I think the basic idea, though, the basic contrast should be kept in a simpler level. Instrumental power is power that you wield. Structural power, you don't have to wield. It's just there. It's there in the background. By virtue of your position, you do things which impose constraints on others and which force them to act in your interests. And that happens independently of your conscious use of that power for those interests. So the simplest and clearest example is that capitalists don't have to have an investment strike. The expression investment strike is used in these discussions to describe a situation in which capitalists get together and say, let's withhold investments in order to bring down the government. Let's engage in a conscious political practice by using our capital in a way to provoke a crisis which will benefit us. Those are quite rare, investment strikes. Disinvestment is ho-hum. It happens all the time. And disinvestment in response to unfavorable political conditions is not an effort to change those political conditions in general. It's simply a response to it. But it reflects the structural power of capital, that it often has the consequence of reversing or slowing down or acting as an obstacle to those processes. And in a well-functioning capitalist system, since politicians understand this, they don't engage in the policies which would provoke disinvestment, knowing that if they did, they'd have to reverse the policies. So progressive politicians often, and in general do, try to create favorable conditions for capital accumulation, even if they're anti-capitalist. And that reflects the structural power of capital. That's not the power of capital to mobilize a military coup or to engage in a concerted disinvestment campaign. It's just the power that they have that comes from their control over the allocation of resources for investment. Okay, I think we should take our break and come back at a quarter after. We're making progress. Quarter after.